Coming up, Fred DeSam Lazaro on the refugee crisis next door. And Kim Lawton talks with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Geraldine Brooks about why religion keeps popping up in her best-selling books.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Concerns continue to rise over spiraling Palestinian-Israeli violence. Religious groups across the spectrum have been urging special prayers for peace, as well as renewed efforts at negotiations. Israelis have heightened security, especially around holy sites. Palestinians in the West Bank city of Nablus firebombed the place revered by many as the tomb of Joseph from the Bible. The escalated violence began more than a month ago with clashes in Jerusalem at the site known to Jews as the Temple Mount and to Muslims as the Noble Sanctuary. Deadly attacks have now spread to many areas. In Washington, Secretary of State John Kerry and his Ambassador for International Religious Freedom, Rabbi David Saperstein, released the government's annual report about violations of religious practice around the world. This year's report said non-governmental entities such as ISIS and Boko Haram have become the principal persecutors of faith groups. But Kerry also criticized governments that restrict religion under the guise of fighting terrorism.
As much as we oppose the actions of terrorists, we do not agree with governments that use those crimes as a pretext for prohibiting religious activities that are, in fact, nonviolent and legitimate.
Among other concerns, the report criticized the rising number of anti-Semitic incidents, especially in Europe. Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby also discussed European anti-Semitism during his visit to the U.S. this week. The spiritual leader of the Worldwide Anglican Communion spoke at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. He called for more dialogue to address religiously motivated violence. Welby recently discovered that his late father was Jewish. He said Christian leaders in particular have a responsibility to speak out more against anti-Semitism in Europe.
I don't think there's a rise of anti-Semitism. I think there's a reemergence of a latent anti-Semitism that is deeply embedded in European culture and always has been.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon this week said the resettlement of migrants flooding into Europe is a global responsibility. He said every country needs to help. Meanwhile, several prominent European politicians specifically called on the U.S. and Arab states to take in more refugees. The European Union's Border Control Agency says more than 700,000 migrants have entered EU countries so far this year, more than twice as many as the total in 2014. We have a special report now on our own refugee crisis next door. The migrants are from Central America, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. If they stay home, they risk kidnapping, extortion, and worse from the drug gangs there. So they head north, risking extortion and kidnapping from more drug gangs and arrest by the U.S.-backed Mexican police. Fred DeSam Lazaro spoke with some of the survivors in Saltillo in northern Mexico, where a Jesuit priest offers shelter.
The Spanish began arriving in Saltillo in the late 1500s. In the late 1990s, the trains began arriving as the city became a major North American free trade hub. Today, thousands of rail cars carry goods made in Mexico north to the U.S. They also carry undocumented migrants from Central America. Many will hop off in Saltillo for the final 200-mile stretch to the Texas border, hoping to avoid not just Mexican and U.S. authorities, but also criminal gangs. One of the few safe harbors here is the Casa del Migrante, started by 72-year-old Pedro Pantoja, a Jesuit priest.
El migrante.
Every migrant is a potential kidnapping victim, and their criminals extort up to $5,000 in order to set them free.
And now, he says, they must contend with immigration authorities in Mexico.
With pressure and aid from the U.S. government, Mexican authorities have been clamping down on Central American migration, and the number of people making it as far north as the U.S. border has dropped significantly. But they haven't stopped coming.
Ellos están cansados.
These guys are really tired. They just got here early this morning.
The new arrivals eluded the Mexican migrant dragnet, which deported 25,000 Central Americans in the first 2 months of 2015, double the number from a year earlier. Unaccompanied minors, thousands of whom were once reaching the U.S., are intercepted long before they could get this far north. Why do they persist, I asked.
The answer is what one migrant said to me. Yes, I fear organized crime. I fear the police. But I fear hunger more, and violence. They are the strongest motivators.
Many of the mostly male migrants say they are fleeing conscription into the criminal gangs that now dominate urban life in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, nations with among the world's highest homicide rates.
They have young gang members on every street corner, and they know exactly who lives in every house, who goes in and out.
This 22-year-old wanted his identity concealed to protect family back home. He escaped El Salvador, only to be apprehended along with four fellow migrants by Mexican police along their train journey. They weren't arrested, but they were instead stripped, forced into a nearby pond, and robbed, he told me.
They took all of our money, our phones, shoes, and they threw our clothes in the water. They were laughing at us.
They found refuge in a church, he said, and were eventually referred to this shelter.
We get the details of each person. This allows me to communicate with their families. If they get kidnapped, if they die, if they end up in jail or get lost on the route.
Santos was being registered on this morning.
From which country?
Honduras.
And a telephone number that we can reach loved ones?
He's hoping to return to Texas, where he worked undocumented for years before a fateful traffic stop led to his deportation. Going to the U.S. is far more perilous now, he says.
In the 90s, you could easily cross. Now they own the river. If they catch you, they'll beat you up, even kill you. The only way now is to find a good coyote.
Coyotes, or traffickers usually tied to gangs, charge about $4,000, he says, though other reports put the price tag much higher, with no guarantees. Santos tried once before in 2010 and did make it into the U.S., barely, but was immediately caught and sent back by the Border Patrol.
Why do you want to take the risk, given, you know, how dangerous this journey is?
Because the situation in Honduras is that for a 46-year-old, no one will give you a job in my line of work, construction. If you try to start your own business, no matter how small, the gangs would extort any earnings.
My life was threatened by the gangs because I couldn't afford to pay the extortion.
36-year-old Maver also fled Honduras, leaving behind her small shop and two older children. She brought her 3-year-old, Emily, on a journey that turned from tiring to terrifying. She says Emily was snatched from her by men who'd posed as good Samaritans, offering to help them.
It was about 3:30 in the morning. It was really dark. That's when they came and took my child. They shoved me to the ground, took the child, and said I had to pay $10,000 to get her back.
Sensing her anguish, the often hostile Mexican authorities were sympathetic, she said, as were many strangers.
I'll never forget being in church on Mother's Day and watching all these mothers with their children and wondering, where is my child?
In the end, Emily was found in the custody of child protection authorities, apparently turned over by her kidnappers, though no one will say, and the child does not remember.
The moment I lifted her up was the happiest moment of my life. To hug her, to know she was alive. Emily told me she was very scared, kept saying, "Why did you leave me to travel by myself? Why did you leave me alone?" Now every time I hug her, I tell her she's not alone.
With so much worry about crime, it's easy to forget that the journey, walking and stowing away on freight trains, is physically tiring and dangerous. Getting your leg jammed between train cars, for instance. That happened to 50-year-old Laura, who then fell to the ground in excruciating pain.
I thought I was going to die. All I kept thinking was, let me die in a town so they'll be able to identify me and take me back to my family. And then I saw a man and shouted for him, and he called the Red Cross.
After 3 days in the hospital, she was brought here, where she'll wait several months for her wound to heal, for a prosthesis, and then rehab. After that, she says, she'll continue her journey north.
I know it will be more difficult, but what else can I do? I have to support a family, not just my daughter, but I have grandchildren. They don't even have a place to live.
She can stay here for as long as she needs. Unlike other shelters along the long migrant route, this one has no time limit.
Toda la persona.
All people who come here injured or hurt, they do not leave here until they're completely recovered. They have to leave here as persons who are free and with dignity.
Some migrants engage in crimes, he said, but the numbers are grossly exaggerated. Over the years, he said, the shelter has convinced a once skeptical and fearful local community to support his work, now with donations of cash in kind and moral support that helps protect it from local gangs.
Libro del Génesis.
In Genesis chapter 12, God called Abraham to be a migrant. In reality, we are all migrants.
But with varying fortunes. The shelter helped Marvera and Emily get a humanitarian visa to legally be in Mexico. That will allow her to make a much safer bus journey to Texas. Guadalupe Arguello, who works at the shelter, says Marvera has a decent chance to plead her case for asylum based on the threat to her life.
Que las mamás con sus hijos.
In our experience, based on the experience of other mothers with children, yes. Also, she has family in the U.S. who will help her financially and legally.
That's not an option for Santos, who was preparing for the perilous hike to the U.S. border. His main task, to find a trafficker with both a good track record getting people across and one willing to take most of the payment once Santos gets there. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in Saltillo, Mexico.
In other news, a series of anti-Muslim protests in front of U.S. mosques last weekend did not result in the confrontations and violence many had feared. A social media campaign called the Global Rally for Humanity had urged the protests as a stand against what it called radical Islam. But few people actually showed up. At some mosques, Muslims passed out food and water and invited the protesters in for dialogue. Interfaith groups had urged their members to attend mosques in solidarity with Muslims, and in many areas, the Muslim supporters far outnumbered the protesters. At his general audience on Wednesday, Pope Francis asked forgiveness for recent scandals that have occurred in the Vatican, but he did not cite any specific scandal. In the last few weeks, a low-ranking Vatican official was dismissed after he came out with his same-sex partner, and a prominent Polish church spokesman and priest was stripped of his duties amid reports that he had fathered a child. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Geraldine Brooks released a new historical novel this month about the biblical King David. Brooks is a former foreign correspondent turned novelist. She says religion keeps popping up in all of her best-selling books. Kim Lawton visited Brooks at her home on Martha's Vineyard, where they talked about the spiritual influences on the author's life and work.
Good morning, beasties.
At her year-round home on Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, Geraldine Brooks is getting breakfast for her family's three alpacas. The Australian-born author finds a simple joy in caring for her animals and appreciating the beauty around her. Brooks is a convert to Judaism. She says her spirituality is closely tied to the natural world.
I find most of my inspiration in nature. I don't know if there is a literal creator, but I can love creation.
Religious themes and characters have been a hallmark of Brooks's historical novels. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, March, centered on the absent clergyman father in Little Women and explored his moral struggles during the Civil War. Her best-selling 2008 novel, People of the Book, created an elaborate interfaith backstory for a 600-year-old Jewish manuscript that survived the Inquisition, the Holocaust, and the Bosnian War. Her new novel, The Secret Chord, focuses on the biblical King David. In all of her work, Brooks says she's drawn to the human quest for meaning.
I'm fascinated by the questions. I don't have any answers, but I love looking at how human beings have grappled with these questions over time.
Brooks grew up in an Irish Catholic family that she describes as pretty churchy.
We went to Catholic school. I was educated by the nuns all the way from kindergarten to the end of high school.
Brooks says she fell away from the church in her teens after becoming disillusioned over issues including the treatment of women and the teachings against birth control.
I was traveling happily as an agnostic. and then I came to the United States for graduate school and fell in love with the man who was going to be my husband, and he was Jewish.
That man, fellow journalist Tony Horowitz, would also become a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Brooks says he wasn't especially concerned about their religious differences, but she was, especially because the Jewish faith is passed down through mothers.
I thought that given the recent history of the 20th century and what had happened to Jewish families in the Holocaust, that I could make a gesture towards that history by converting to Judaism so that our children would be Jewish.
Brooks says her conversion was more about history than faith, but there are many aspects of Judaism that resonate with her, particularly the emphasis on prayer. She offers frequent prayers to what she describes as no fixed address.
Even though I am not at all sure that anybody is listening, I find that I have this compulsion to offer up little prayers, and it is kind of in the Jewish tradition to do that. You notice something, you express gratitude for it. I also find that if I hear an ambulance siren, I say, please help them. I don't know who I'm saying it to, but I feel like moved in my soul to say it.
Early in her career, Brooks was a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, covering war zones in the Middle East and the Balkans. She's also a breast cancer survivor of more than 10 years. She says both experiences have heightened her appreciation for being in the moment.
We're always running our minds on the next thing and getting and spending and power plays and all the nonsense that we fill our days with. So I think also having a potentially life-threatening illness and getting out of it in one piece is something that helps you be more appreciative and to just take every day as a gift.
Brooks and Horowitz have two sons, Nathaniel and Bizayo, who was adopted from Ethiopia. The family is a fixture in the small, year-round Martha's Vineyard community. Brooks can be found buying dairy products at their neighbor's farm stand or visiting the stable which houses her beloved horse.
Hi, girl. Hi, gorgeous girl. Hi, gorgeous girl.
The family attends the Martha's Vineyard Hebrew Center, the only synagogue on the island. Brooks praises the leadership of its rabbi, Karen Breutman.
We just have the one little shul. It's a very small community, so it has to embrace a lot of diverse opinions. And I think she's really a genius at holding this diversity together in a really exemplary way.
Brooks says she consulted Breitman while writing her novel about David, especially when it came to conveying what she calls the austere beauty of the biblical Hebrew.
I didn't want it to sound like an English text from that period. I wanted it to have more of the resonance of the Hebrew, which can be very poetic, but also can be extremely blunt.
Brooks's interest in David was ignited years ago when her oldest son told her he wanted to play the harp. That got her thinking about the boy harpist in Scripture. She started rereading his story.
And I'm thinking, whoa, this is very Game of Thrones.
She says she was fascinated by David's loves and battles and all the conspiracies over succession.
And so to try and use imaginative empathy to fill in the gaps that Scripture leaves became such an intriguing challenge to me. And also, I took a lot of consolation in that I'm not the first to take this on.
In The Secret Court, David's story is told through the eyes of the prophet Nathan, who often castigates the king. Among Brooks's research sources were the writings of the late Jewish theologian Abraham Joshua Heschel.
What I really loved about researching this book was reading Heschel on the Hebrew prophets. He says, you know, these are some of the most confounding and troublesome men who ever lived. And I've always been attracted to brave idealists, the people who take the human condition, the ethical framework, and push it a bit further.
Some biblical scholars have speculated about the close friendship between David and Yonatan, or Jonathan, the son of Israel's King Saul. In Brooks's telling, the two have a sexual relationship.
I think everybody interprets Scripture according to their own times, and I really feel an honest reading of the passages relating to how their souls were knit together, and the extraordinary outpouring of emotion in the lament for Yonatan that David writes, called the Song of the Bow, when he says, "Your love was greater to me than the love of any woman." And this is a guy who's loved a lot of women.
Brooks's David is a complicated man. She says that's his appeal.
He is a flawed character, but he's a flawed character in Scripture. And he's the first to admit his flaws. And that's one of the things that draws me to him, because so many powerful men, particularly, are flawed. The story of David isn't date stamped, and it's because he does embody the dark and the light of the human condition that I think is one of the reasons that we're pulled back to the story time and time again.
Is there a sequel in the works about Solomon?
Well, that's an interesting idea. There's certainly a lot to say about Solomon, and the story, I do leave the story at a pretty important crux. So who knows? We'll see if Nathan speaks to me again.
Whatever the topic of her next historical novel, chances are good it too will have religious themes.
If you're going to write about the past, you can't ignore faith, because faith was in many ways the defining characteristic of so many lives in the past. So good luck not writing about it.
I'm Kim Lawton on Martha's Vineyard.
On our calendar this coming week, Baha'is celebrate the birth of the Bab. They believe in the early 1800s, the Bab was a messenger of God who prepared the way for the founder of their faith, Baha'u'llah. Hindus continue celebrating their nine-night festival of Navratri, which honors the goddess Durga and her many manifestations. And Shiite Muslims observe Ashura, which recalls the martyrdom of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Hussein. Many commemorate the day with public expressions of mourning and grief, including, for some, self-flagellation. Finally, how's this for good works? The worshipers at an evangelical church outside Columbus, Ohio, were wrapping up a sermon series on generosity, so they ordered a pizza to be delivered during the Sunday service. When the delivery woman arrived, they ushered her onto the stage. The pastor asked her what was the biggest tip she'd ever received. She said about $10. He then gave her a big pile of cash that had been collected from the congregation. It was more than $1,000. The single mother said the money saved her from being evicted from her home. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from a special service to dedicate the new chapel at Virginia Theological Seminary. The previous chapel from the 1800s was destroyed by fire 5 years ago.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.